Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
From MyDomain.com, this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. I'm your host, Hillary Kerr, and today I am delighted to welcome a woman who many of you have been asking for over the past few weeks, the founder and chief creative officer of Bando, Jen Gotch, who is also the host of a new podcast called Jen Gotch is Okay, Sometimes. So Jen created this multi-million-dollar brand that sells all kinds of lifestyle awesomeness, from iPhone cases to home decor to mugs to graphic tees to jewelry to backpacks to stationery and more. It's optimistic, it's affordable, it's a little nostalgic, and it's unabashedly playful. It's also wildly popular, and Bando products are currently available in more than 3,000 stores in over 50 countries, as well as on the brand's website. They are emotional purchases, which is part of what makes them so powerful. Also powerful, the story of how Jen got here. From her early days as a food and prop stylist to her current place at the helm of Bando, this is Jen Gotch on Second Life. So Jen, as always with this podcast, we like to start at the beginning.
I love it.
Which seems like a logical place to start. So what did you study in school and what did you think you were going to be?
Oh, I studied literature and philosophy and I thought I was going to be a lawyer.
Really?
Yeah, I was pre-law. I took 3 years of Latin, which I've still not really been able to incorporate.
I feel like there's a good jewelry line in there somewhere.
Yeah, something.
There's something, or like crests,
yeah,
or something. So you thought you were going to be a lawyer.
I did, yeah.
What turned you away from that?
Prepping for the LSAT, actually, because I was taking the course and I was kind of looking around at the people in the class and I didn't feel like I just didn't feel like I was vibing with it. And I really didn't understand about like thinking about a career in that sense. You know, it was like you could be a doctor, a lawyer, a business person. I didn't know that all these other things existed. And I thought, like, do I really want to get better at arguing? I was quite an argumentative young person. And I just thought, I don't want to do this. So I just like changed my mind, which wasn't great because there's not that much that you can do with a degree in literature and philosophy outside of like teach or start a company. I guess there is a lot you can do.
My BA is in British literature.
Oh, okay. So look at us.
You need to know how to read and write.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
True. I did learn that.
So tell me about your first adult job. And by that, I mean like a post-college, I'm a grown-up now, like you have taxes taken out. Job.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely worked retail, but that didn't feel very grown up. But I was definitely running the front desk at Ann Taylor. I'm a late bloomer, so I feel like career-wise it didn't start until I got into food and prop styling, which was – I was like 29. Okay. So everything leading up to that, although technically – there were taxes involved, but I was still sort of drifting.
So how did you get into food styling? Which, by the way, can you also explain
what
that
food
is?
Styling
because
is?
I know and I'm obsessed because I used to cover food when I worked for Elle Magazine once upon a time ago.
Oh,
and we
gosh.
Would hire people like you for,
yeah,
shoots for Elle. But Maybe you should just explain
it. Well, it's a hidden art. I mean, I obviously didn't know about it either. I had actually heard – I had done like on-set dressing and stuff early in my swirly phase. And I knew about that. And someone had mentioned prop styling to me years ago. It's interesting in my history, there are little times where people actually said the job I ended up – like my aunt said I should be a food stylist when I was like 11.
Wow.
And it just like popped in there. But – it didn't resurface, you know, for 20 years. But so I was interested in prop styling, and I at the time there was this thing called Debbie's Book, and you could kind of go on. I think it still exists, but you could go on and, like, see other prop styles. Like, you know, I was asking for work, so I just started emailing people and saying, like, I'm interested in this career. Do you have any work for me? And I inadvertently emailed a food stylist. Now, I didn't know how to cook. I only knew how to eat at that point, had no training. But she was like, I need someone tomorrow. Will you work for free? And I was like, sure.
Is this in L.A.?
Yeah.
So you cold emailed a food stylist.
Yes.
And with no anything, you just said, yes, I'm going to do it. And you showed up on set. Did you know what your responsibilities were going to be?
No.
Or what skills you needed to have?
I assumed that I didn't have the skills, but that since it was free labor, I would be learning, which I did. I learned a ton that day. It was an infomercial for like a convection oven. So it was all about like making a turkey look in different phases of being cooked. So food styling is essentially any video imagery commercials you see of food. There is someone in charge of making that food look great. And at this time, which was, I don't know what that was, late 90s, early 2000s, the digital photography was really only just beginning. So the techniques were very different. And also the image that was being portrayed was very perfect. So everything was very pristine and calculated, which goes against everything that I am. So that was an interesting thing to learn. But it was artistry. I mean, you painted the turkey.
Because you couldn't fix it in post There's no Photoshop for the turkey.
No. And there were lights, and it had to hold up take after take. So you couldn't really cook a lot of the food. So a lot of the things you were seeing at that time were fake in one way or another.
So what were you painting the turkey with?
It's like a browning liquid. I mean, it was like straight up from the 70s.
So it's like a raw turkey.
It's essentially like a slightly cooked turkey painted with this browning liquid, and then you would take a torch, like what you would do with like creme brulee, and like hit it. No, it's crazy. The things that I had a paint stripper to make grill marks on things. I know how to make fake ice cream. Like,
how do you make fake ice cream?
I did a thing for Oprah magazine, and it was like 25 scoops of different flavored ice cream that had to stay for a day. It was crazy.
So after that first day, did you think, you said like, yeah, this is for me?
I was like, this is so cool. You know, it was just like such a different perspective on like A, jobs, and B, like looking at things from a, this is how it's created, which I didn't even, I mean, like I had ideas those things existed, but I really was interested, and I wanted to learn how to cook. So I ended up working for her for a couple years, this particular food stylist. And then I also, you know, a couple weeks later met a prop stylist who also did food. So they were kind of my mentors in a way. When you're an assistant, it's just like you're just learning on the job. So,
and for the people who don't know what prop styling is, can you explain that?
Sure. So prop styling is essentially where the food stylist makes the food. The prop stylist would bring the plate and the table and the linens, or maybe if it's like a living room set, you know, the Pottery Barn catalog, you're setting all of that up and putting flowers in the vase and just making things look. It's basically like set design, you know, interior design actually for photography, which is also like a super fun art form. And someone for me who was like, I think actually quite commitment phobic about work, a long job was a week.
So did you like the freelance nature of it?
I did, because it's like you cycled through so much. And then also, like, if it was a job that didn't feel great, you knew you weren't like tethered to it for
It's not like you're going to be sitting next to Frank and, you know, exactly. in finance for exactly. the rest of your life.
Yeah, it's like you could basically get through anything, and every job was different, so it was super exciting.
Were you crafty as an individual? Because to me, there's a little bit of hearing this makes me think there has to be, it's like equal parts artistry and having like a photographer's eye, but then with this DIY aspect to it.
For sure.
Was that in your DNA? Was that
I mean, it wasn't like I was always doing projects. I don't think I identified. You know, it's interesting because now I have the opportunity. One of the pros of getting older is like I can look back and be like, oh, that all makes sense now. At the time, like I was like, this seems cool. That seems cool. I guess I'm good at that. You know, I think though at its core, it's about creative problem solving, which is a definite through line in my career. And it's something I really love to do. And so it was like, yeah, how are we going to make this happen? We have a short period of time to deliver on the promise. And, you know, that was the most fun part. And it was scary, too. But it was like, you know, then you had a sense of accomplishment almost every day. So
what did you not like about it?
Well, that the creative problem solving. I'm complicated. You know, I hadn't really identified anxiety as anxiety, but there was a lot of unknown. So the part where I just said it was great that you didn't have to be on a job for too long also meant you were on a new job, sometimes multiple times a week, meeting people that oftentimes had worked together for years. And, you know, it could be very intimidating. And
it's like starting a new school every week.
Yes. So the unknown was scary to me, but also it must have also been intriguing because I stuck with it for so long. But yeah.
So do you remember some of those like early jobs when you went out on your own?
Yeah.
Like, who some of your clients were, some of the things that you were making?
Yeah, I did. I did a week's worth of Dairy Queen commercials. One of the commercials was for the Blizzard, which is like their thick shake. And they wanted to be able to have the actor like hold the cup upside down to show how thick the shake is. They're like, could you do that? And I was like, yeah, I could definitely do that. And then I was like, how would I do that? But I figured it out. I just mixed a bunch of stuff together. But that was a fun job. I did the Crate and Barrel catalog, and which was I remember the first day I can't remember what it's called. There's another name for fishing line, and I can't remember what it was. And I had only known monofilament. And he was like, you have monofilament, right? And I was like, uh-huh. And then I was like, oh, God. And there was no, like, you didn't have smartphones. You couldn't, like, Google it. I was just like.
You were, like, still texting by pressing the letter A three times.
I know. So I don't even know if we were there yet. And I happened to know one of the guys on the crew. I'm like, hey. What's monofilament? And he's like, it's fishing line. I was like, oh, okay, I have that. But so it's like they were all good jobs, but it was basically, you know, like that. Like you were just like
you were prepared. Successful.
Yeah, I was. You know what though? I think I actually chalk a lot of my success to perseverance, like, and not, I just wouldn't quit. Like I wouldn't stop shopping or prepping for a job until everything was closed. Like I just, you know, just grinding. And then I think like my optimism and sense of humor, it was like a nice addition to a set dynamic. And I honestly think I got hired on a lot of jobs more because I was like fun to be around and less because I was the best stylist in town.
Well, I'm sure you were great. But then the other part of it is like, who doesn't want to work with people who they enjoy?
Yeah,
if you can
give
a job to two people and they're equally talented, you definitely want to give it to the person who's awesome.
Yeah, you really do. But those are the types of things they don't necessarily teach you in school.
Or ever,
unless you experience it and then eventually become someone who hires people. And then, you know, you make your decisions on that. I mean, I've definitely not hired people that were amazing because I'm like, they're not going to be awesome to be around, you know?
Yeah. And that can affect everything else.
It really can, yeah.
So then you also became a photographer.
I did.
So how did you make that leap and why did you decide to expand?
Yeah. I wanted more money. And
that's a reasonable reason.
So being on set as a food stylist and a prop stylist, you realize you're in control of a lot of of what is being shot. And not to say that, I mean, I worked with so many amazing photographers. I also loved photography. So it seemed like a natural transition. But there were some jobs where I'm like, I'm basically doing everything. I was telling them where to put the lights. Like, I was doing everything except for taking the picture. And they were making at times like 5-10 times what I was making. And I was like, I feel like I could do it. And so I did. I mean, and once digital photography, which, you know, commercial photographers at the time were really upset when digital started coming through, because there's a lot in film cameras that's harder to, you know, a lot of it relies on your skill set. Whereas, like, with digital, you can frame it up, you can fix a lot of stuff. So I just, like, kind of jumped in.
Did you teach yourself?
I had been, like, shooting just for fun for a long time. And being on set for that long, you have a lot of downtime. So I would just, like, pay attention to, like, what the photographer was doing.
So still learning on set.
Yeah, for sure. And then my ex-husband was a photographer and actually taught at the university level. So, like, once he got in the mix, I was like, oh, we're done. He does lighting. We're solid. I'm a photographer now.
Okay, so that's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
What made you want to have another outlet and start Bandeau? And was it, like, a side hustle at first?
Yeah. You'll see, like, the through line for me is, like, there's no planning. I'm not like, I mean, the deciding to transition into photography was probably the most planning I ever did, and that wasn't even a plan. I was like, I have a camera. Maybe I'll just start telling people I'm a photographer. With Bandeau, it was like Jamie, who you've met, yeah. So she co-founded it with me. We were both styling at the time. She was assisting me on some jobs. She was doing wardrobe. And I felt like we just kind of popped into the creative consciousness with this idea for – we had each made some. They were like floral halos, essentially. And so I was like, I kind of want to sell them. And she was like, I kind of want to sell mine. And so we're like, let's just do it. Like, yeah, it really was meant to just be fun.
Do you remember the first piece that you made?
Well, I made a piece for myself. Andrew, my ex-husband, and I were going to renew our vows in Vegas because I had a styling job in Vegas on our anniversary, and I made this thing, and so that's, like, the first Bandeau, essentially. And then when Jamie—
What did it look like?
It was just, like, wire, ribbon-wrapped wire with all these vintage flowers on it. I have pictures of it. I still have it. It was weird because it was it's like a few years before the Coachella, you know, stuff. So people were like, I remember I wore it out in Vegas and people were like, what is that on your head? I'm like, it's an adornment. So when Jamie and I went to start, we basically just like got all these materials and churned out, like, we each made like 20. You probably remember that more than
I was going to say, I remember stuff. Because so we started Who What Wear in 2006. And I remember going to your old office on Beverly.
Yep.
I don't know if it was like late 2008 or if it was in 2009.
Yeah.
It was relatively early on. And I own some of like the OG pieces.
That's amazing.
Because I've always loved like head. Anything that goes on your head.
They were, like, beautiful. Not to brag, but I was like, they were like the coolest things we've made.
And they were super cool. No one was doing anything like that. And it felt really fresh. How were you selling them and where were you selling them originally?
Very slowly. No, just kidding. we were selling out because we, you know, there weren't that many. And I was like, well, this is it. We have hit the big time. But it was, which we hadn't. I was confused about what the big time was. Still trying to figure that out. But we were just selling on our website. You know, wholesale.
You say that like it's just like, oh, we just had a website.
Well, it was like just a website at that time.
So you're still a photographer. Mm-hmm. Are you still food styling and prop styling?
I was still doing some prop styling because that's where I was making the most money because Bandeau obviously wasn't making, I mean, it was making some money, but we were just funneling it back into the business. And then I had really started pursuing, like I shot like a cover story for Real Simple. Like I was like doing it and I was going to partner up with a friend of mine who was an amazing photographer, much better than I was. And we were like building a portfolio site. And then I just realized like, man, I'm not going to be able to do two big endeavors like that at the same time. So I chose Bandeau.
What made you do that?
You know what? It's a weird thing with Bandeau. It, even when it didn't make any sense, I just chose it. over everything. It wasn't even, I mean, I must have on a cellular level known. Sometimes it's like being in love with the wrong guy, you know, but you just like, it doesn't matter. You're just so in love and you just feel so fueled by it that, I mean, the first 4 years, I mean, it's still hard, but it's a different kind of hard now. But like, I sacrificed a lot during that time and it was like,
without even thinking about it.
Yeah, and I think from the outside looking in, people would be like, why wouldn't you just walk away? Like, it's not working. And I was just like,
nope. I'm here. In it to win it.
In it to win it,
So you started a website and mm-hmm. you put your 40 collectively
pieces on it. Yeah, one-of-a-kind vintage pieces.
How did you market it? How did you?
Yeah, So this was 2008. I had a blog. I was in the like blogosphere, but you know, 2008 blogs are much different than today.
There
was
sure no,
like, you know, that was all that there was, the social media and Flickr. I was like really active on Flickr, which was like a photo sharing site. And the night before we launched, I like Joy from Oh Joy, Jordan from Oh Happy Day. Like I knew all those guys digitally, knew them, and I was like, hey, we're doing this thing. You know, if you're interested in, and back then, you know, everybody was just looking for content. It wasn't like about sponsored posts or anything like that. It was just they wanted whatever was new. So like,
it's just editorial outreach.
For sure. By the end of the first day, it was on like 150 blogs and it was crazy. And I was like, oh, okay. That's when I was like, we're definitely going to be rich. I called my agent. I was like, you don't have to book me on jobs anymore. I'm going to be so wealthy. Like, we sold out. And then I did the math later
on, like,
that week.
Price per unit,
well,
and like
it's sold.
Time and all of that.
But also, well, our margins were great because they were retailing for like $100 to $350. And it definitely, retail margins
margin
were great. Yeah. But the fact that you could only sell it one time.
not as great.
And the material resources were not infinite because we were doing all vintage. So, we reconfigured after a while. But I knew there was something, you know.
Who was your first major retailer? Because you started selling elsewhere pretty quickly, too.
Yeah. It took a while. I think in about year two, Anthropologie reached out to us, which was like—
Did you die?
Died.
Like,
screamed.
On the floor.
Yes. Like, everything that you would imagine happening happened. I remember we went to the Viceroy in Santa Monica for our meeting.
Do you remember what you wore?
I do. I still have a picture of it. It's this. I still have the dress. This was like this really like sort of 60s vintage A-line dress. I just remember we agreed to everything. I was like, no matter what they ask for, yes. And then we will just sort it out later because this is Anthropologie.
Your ethos.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you knew the value. Even if there wasn't going to be that much money to be made, you knew the value. And they did add, we did not make any money initially from them, but they did add a ton of value to our business.
And just awareness, brand awareness.
For sure. And
you can
so much
that.
Experience on our end to understand how to like manufacture for someone else and what a margin was, because at that point they were saying margins and I was like, I don't know what that word means, but like I'll just write it down and shake my head yes and call somebody later. So invaluable. And a vote of confidence too, which is like when you're a small business, you know, someone that's established to say like, hey, we choose you was – you know,
and
great.
And they pursued you.
They did.
Which is also a really amazing thing when someone knocks on your door.
For sure. We had a lot of things like that happen. I think that was a big part of what kept me in it is like I could see that this, you know, there must be something. I don't think I knew what it was, but I was like, there must be something because I know other people that have businesses and this isn't happening to them.
So at what point did you decide to transition from one-of-a-kind pieces to even replicated pieces to a larger product assortment?
Yeah. Well, the transitioning from one-of-a-kind came pretty quickly. And also the recession.
Right.
Yeah, because we're like, ugh. But the recession hit shortly after we launched the business. And like, you'll know this, like from an editor's standpoint, everyone was like, what's your under 50 story? And we didn't have anything like that. So we were like, let's do this other thing that's like a watered-down version. And we tried a bunch of stuff. We had a bridal line. So we we got into like replicating what the one-of-a-kind pieces were pretty quickly. And then it was a few years before we tried other products because we didn't have any...
You, like, didn't have a tote bag manufacturer in
exactly,
your back pocket?
Exactly. Like, we were still making a lot of the stuff by hand. So, yeah, we found someone who had white phone cases, and they're like, you have a 2x2 printable area. We're like, just put a red heart on it. And they sold out in, like, an hour, and we had never had anything like that happen. I was like, this is interesting data.
Whoa.
So that really started it, and then we sold the business. So the rest of, like, what you see now is due to our parent company. I would have never been able to figure that out.
So at what point in how long had you had the business before you sold it, and then you stayed on?
Mm-hmm.
And how has that been?
Amazing. So it was probably in around year three that we decided we were going to sell, because not because we thought we were a super valuable company. We really weren't at that point. But Jamie was planning to move out of state, and there was no way. I wasn't going to be able to do it on my own. I didn't want to take on like an investor or anything like that. And so we're like – and people had jobs. I felt responsible for them.
How big was your team at the time?
Not big. I mean, there was like Jamie and I, maybe two full-time, and then like some part-time people that came in and made stuff.
Those first hires?
Yeah.
Are the scariest hires.
Oh, my gosh.
Because you're like, oh, my God, I'm responsible for this person.
For sure. Yeah.
And it's terrifying. Okay,
yeah.
So you had a team.
Yeah.
Jamie was leaving.
So we're like – and you know what? Like, still so naive just to the ways of the world. We're like, let's just try and sell it. You know? This should be easy. And it strangely was easier than it should have been. And honestly, knowing everything I know now, we were so incredibly lucky. Lifeguard Press is the company that bought us. They're private, like, it's a family-owned company. The owners are my age. They're good friends of mine now. They were strangers at the time. But they were, you know, a licensing company, which means they take larger brands and they produce products on behalf of that brand and then do like a revenue share. So they were just looking for a brand, voice, aesthetic. And then they didn't care about the rest. And that, and all we had was
like,
that.
We got that.
Yeah.
So how did you meet them?
Jamie had a friend who was in a YP, a Young Presidents organization out here. And he let us take one of his chapter emails to, like, that can go to everyone to, as like, hey, this is our company. We're trying to sell it. We got a ton of, because the thing is, and you might remember this too, like, because of our styling and my photography background, it looked like we were like an actual operation. Like, people would come into that office on Beverly and be like, this is Bandeau? And we're like, yeah, it's just us and like a camera and a pink seamless. So we got a ton of interest, but once we kind of showed them like the business, they were like, oh yeah, no, this isn't really a business. And then it kind of just kept whittling down, and then it ended up down to like two people. And I was like, I really was connecting with Todd and Kim, the owners of Lifeguard Press. And I was like, I want to do it. And no one was going to buy it without me. Like, I kind of came with the deal.
Because that's something that I think is so interesting about your story. I mean, like, there are like 90 things that are interesting about your story. But one of the things is that you hear of people creating companies and selling them, and then they're either like running out the clock waiting until they can get out the door, or they leave immediately to move on to something else. But I feel like you have only thrived since selling remaining a part of it.
Yeah.
Am I incorrect?
No, absolutely. No, totally correct. I think a lot of times, too, the people that what you just described, they've been at it for years. They had a plan going in. They knew that
it was
a
stepping stone.
Exactly. I was like, exit strategy. We got 401ks like a year or two ago, and the guy was like, what year are you retiring? I was like, I think I'm dying at work. I never like considered retiring. So I just wanted to see where it could go. So like, to be able to offload, how are people getting paid? How am I getting paid? How are we manufacturing, distributing, selling, growing, financing? That seemed like a gift to be like, hey, can you just bring your ideas to the table? I was like, that's my favorite thing to do. Sure. You know, and I knew I was going to learn a lot, and I did.
Are you a good manager?
I would say I'm a really good boss. because I've had some really bad bosses and I knew early on the type of boss that I wanted to be. I would say as a manager, there have been times where it's been challenging because I'm not great at accountability. I want to be liked. I want people to feel good. I want to entertain them. And that doesn't always work, you know, when there's a job to be done. I just got so lucky in that the group of girls that have been with me for years know what I mean when I'm like, maybe we should do that. And like one of the girls, she's told me this a couple times. She's like, you know, you have to ask for it directly now because the other people don't know that you're that's you saying get this done. And it's been really, I mean, when we grew, that was really challenging for me specifically as a manager, because I didn't know how to manage a team. And some people are great at that, especially like very linear people. I'm just not that way, and I just don't want to be tethered to that sort of thing. It just cancels out the other part that I think I'm really good at. So I've tried to just create something where I could be an okay manager, a great boss, and then add value in other ways.
So what's your favorite thing that you've created product-wise?
And
I get it. Like, I understand you love them all.
Yeah, I know.
Like, they're all special to you in different
ways.
Listen,
that's not true. There's a lot that I'm like, oh, gosh. But that's also part of the creative process when it's exciting when you're in concepting. And then by the time a year later, you're just like, this is old news. But our planner, which is like one of our – it's probably our best-selling product. And we really went after it as like, what can we add to a crowded market? Like, what can we do that's original? And we really infused it with so much of like what our brand ended up being. And the reception was – so insane that it's just like this little encapsulation of Bando that people can interact with every day. So that's probably my favorite if I had to pick one.
So you just started a podcast.
I did.
That I am a subscriber of and that I love. And it's
Thank
called
you.
Jen Gotch is Okay.
Yeah.
Sometimes. And everyone should download it immediately. It's available on iTunes.
Thank you.
What do you like about having a podcast? I know it's early days.
Yeah.
But I feel like you have walked down the path enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I started working on this last December. So I feel like even though the world didn't know I had a podcast, I feel like I've had one for a while. You know, I definitely like having a platform and an audience. Like, I think it's thrilling to like entertain people and connect with people, and you can't really do that in real life all the time. So I like that. I feel like I was craving a new creative outlet because as creative as Bando still is, it tends to be more creative problem solving than like the ideation part because there's so many people doing that. And I was just missing like that from the very beginning, and like, what can I add to the landscape that's not that, you know, I just wanted a challenge. And then the, you know, mental health advocacy was just like this accident. And when Sophia, you know, I do the podcast with Girl Boss, and when Sophia asked me to do it, she was like, do you want to do a mental health podcast? And I was like, no, why would I want to do that? And then I ended up essentially with a mental health podcast, which, you know, speaks volumes to her visionary capabilities.
Well, it's amazing.
Thanks.
And I know it's early days
for
us as listeners, but I'm really enjoying it. So one of the things that we talk about on this podcast a lot is that there are so many of our listeners, and I know this because they DM me and tell me this, which I love, but they are, you know, having a great career or having a medium career.
Yeah.
They're having a career.
They're having a career, nonetheless.
They're having a career. And there's something else that they want to do, but they just don't know quite how to do it.
Yeah.
So what advice would you give women who are interested in making a leap?
Yeah. I would
professionally
say—
Professionally speaking.
Sure. Don't jump off of anything.
No.
You know, I people reach out to me about that sort of thing a lot, too. And I think a lot of it feels to be sort of caked in fear and, like, not giving yourself permission to do that, whether you're too old or you financially you're not going to be able to do it, or, you know, like, I would be careful about, like, over-rationalizing it and like really vetting the decision. I mean, it's definitely important to vet big decisions like that, but I'm big into like paying attention to what the universe is serving up for me every day and just like taking note. And that doesn't mean the answer doesn't usually hit you in like a lightning bolt, but to kind of collectively gather wisdom. And then when it becomes clear, there's no decision to be made. You just do it. Even the things I'm doing now, I wasn't out pursuing a podcast. I went on Sophia's podcast. And then a couple months later, she was like, do you want to do a podcast? And I was just like, yes, immediately. You know, so I think it's just like being open in the world is important. And then you get the gifts back. And so it's like, don't overthink it.
I like that.
That's what I would do. I don't know. That also will get a lot of people in trouble too.
But I think, you know, like instead of it being caked in fear, why can't it be caked in possibility?
Yeah. Or caked in cake, which how
that
good
sounds
does that
delicious.
Sound?
Cake of a cake? Yes, I would like that very much, please.
So my favorite question is my last question, which is if you could go back in time and talk to your younger self, what advice would you give her? Young Jen.
Yeah, young Jen. Whew.
Hey, young Jen.
Neck cream. This is the first thing that comes to mind. I'm assuming that's not what you're talking about.
Well, I mean, it is a really overlooked anti-aging.
You know, the decolletage. I don't know how to say that, but my mom always used to tell me about that. I was like, lady, get out of here. I'm fine. I'll be young forever.
But so there's no lift.
Yeah, there's no lifts. That. There's no lifts, and it's all exposed. you know, I think that it's just that annoying thing that you say to people now that are younger and they're like, whatever. But it's the idea of like a door closing means like another one is going to open or go in through the window or whatever. You know, I mean, there was like a project I was up for about a year ago and I was super bummed I didn't get it. And I thought, you know what? Something else is going to happen. And it's really is true. Now, at like 23, I would have told me to like take a hike because you haven't experienced it enough to trust that because it's like air. You know, it's hard to prove that. But as someone that has now experienced that where you're like utterly devastated by not getting what you thought you should get, whether it's an opportunity or a boyfriend or what, it's like there literally is always something else that you may not have even known existed. And that continues to happen to me. And I think that would have removed a lot of pain and stress over like a 20, 30-year period of time where I just agonized over things that didn't happen the way I wanted.
I know I try and remember that when things are really bad, that nothing stays bad forever.
I know.
And of course,
nothing
on the flip
stays
side,
good either.
Yeah, there's that. But there is something comforting about that, about realizing like the only constant is change.
Yeah.
And that also, I agree with you. I come from a glasses half full sort of perspective.
Ditto.
And I always have been amazed by the universe has plans far beyond what we can imagine for ourselves as long as we sort of trust and go with it.
Yeah, which is hard because you can't see it. You can feel it if you pay attention. But and the only other thing I would add to that just about bad times and good times and the impermanence is like the gratitude piece I think I've always been like a thank you and that's so nice. But like to really cherish when it is good and be grateful. And even when it's bad, like what can I be grateful for today? Also is like a good stress reliever for me. So there's a lot of stress that could have been relieved. That probably is part of why, you know, things on my body look the way they do now. But
but you
I guess that's
there.
Part of it. Yeah. We both got there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Jen, first of all, in closing, you are the person who our audience has been asking for the most. So
nice.
Thank you. So people have been listening. I got all of your requests for Jen. But thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to come and do this. I really appreciate it. That was founder and chief creative officer of Bando, Jen Gotch. Check out her new podcast, Jen Gotch's OK, Sometimes, on Girl Boss Radio and iTunes. Thank you all for listening to this episode of Second Life. For more interviews with inspiring women like Jen, visit mydomain.com. As always, I'd love to know who you'd like to hear on this show, so send in your suggestions to secondlife@mydomain.com, or you can just DM me on Instagram at Hillary Kerr. If you like today's show, please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to rate and review us. Also, I really love it when you guys help us spread the word of the show, so if you want to screenshot it and put it in your Instagram stories and tag us and tag me, that's cool too. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life by MyDomain.com.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding in your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.